what it means to be a Christian when nothing is sacred. In Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, Paul wrote, "Do everything without complaining or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a crooked and depraved generation in which you shine like stars in the universe." Now, Paul says that Christians here are to be fundamentally different than the people among whom they live, and they are to be obviously different than the people among whom they live. He described the generation in which he lived, but I don't think it was a generation in that sense of one generation out of time. The generation in which the church existed as a crooked and depraved generation. People with serious problems, serious attitude problems, serious value problems, serious worldview problems. A crooked and depraved generation. And Christians are to be quite different. They are to be blameless and pure. Christians are to be children of God without fault in the midst of this crooked and depraved generation. They are to shine, we are to shine, like stars in the universe. Well, back in April, for the week of April 14 through 20, as a matter of fact, TV Guide had a cover dedicated to David Letterman, and Nathaniel says that that's made out of Play-Doh, and I appreciate his innocence in that perspective. Actually, the coloration of the cover was intended to be a part of the message about the man, David Letterman. And we're going to focus a little bit on what the cover had to say about David Letterman. I'm not going to actually read this in its entirety. It's very David Letterman-esque. If you know David Letterman, if you have seen him, watched him on TV, you know his kind of vocabulary and so forth. And this is very much reminiscent of the way he tends to talk in his comedy routines and so forth when he's on television. Energized, refreshed. Now more than ever, nothing is sacred in the world of David Letterman. Isn't that great? Well, is it great when nothing is sacred? Is it great when there are no limits, no lines, when nothing is special, when nothing is worthy of respect? I want to think a little bit about the word sacred. I don't often use English dictionaries in my lessons, but this is one time when I wanted to talk about a couple of words enough to do that. What does the word sacred mean? Well, the first few definitions that you see on the screen here, on the wall up here, talk about things that have to do with religion. And sacred can mean things that have religious connotation. But we also use the word sacred in a more general sense, and that's really the sense that I am most interested in because it has the most to do with the expression, nothing is sacred. And that's the fifth definition up here. Worthy of respect. Venerable. Worthy of respect. Is nothing worthy of respect? Is there anything that is worthy of respect that ought to be treated as being venerable, as being not an appropriate target for comedic diatribe or sarcasm or ridicule? When nothing is sacred, the counterpoint to that is that everything is profane. Profane is pretty much the opposite of sacred. The first definition there is marked by contempt or irreverence for what is sacred. Contempt or irreverence for what is sacred. Number four is the one that I am most interested in for tonight's thinking, and that is vulgar or coarse. When nothing is sacred, when nothing is worthy of reverence, worthy of respect, when nothing is venerable, then everything is vulgar or coarse or contemptible. Nothing is worthy of respect. I'm going to go back to the TV Guide, and I want to look at a couple of the quotes that were in the article about Letterman. Again, this was back in April. There was a whole article about David Letterman and his particular approach to comedy. Make no mistake, no Letterman means no Leno, means no Conan, means no Kilbourne, means no Jon Stewart ad infinitum. Letterman's smart aleck spirit permeates The Simpsons, South Park, The Onion, Tom Green, even SportsCenter, and it is inconceivable to think America would have embraced Seinfeld the way it did without having first been prepared by Letterman's sarcastic worldview. Now, I want you to think about what the writer here is saying, because he's not being critical. Okay, this writer is not being critical of David Letterman. And I'm not picking on David Letterman. It may seem like that at the moment, but I'm not picking on David Letterman. He just is a handy symbol of the kind of point that I want to make about when nothing is sacred, as that cover said about David Letterman. In the world of David Letterman, now more than ever, nothing is sacred. Everything is a fair target. Respect for nothing. Okay. The writer here, in talking about David Letterman, talks about Letterman as being more than merely an icon of our culture. He talks about him as being a trendsetter. And I think that certainly is true. Now, he's not by any means unique in that respect. We could talk about a lot of others who have been trendsetters. If there had been no Carson, there would have been no Letterman. I mean, we can talk about that kind of progression, but the point is, or a point is, that it is a progression that we're talking about here. It is a slippery slope kind of idea that we're talking about here, that as things become more acceptable, as the barriers to what is taboo fall, all they can do is go lower and lower. Now, how many of you know who David Letterman is? Do you even know who David Letterman is? Okay. How many of you know who Leno is? Okay. How many of you know who Conan is? Okay. How about Kilborn? Okay, he's not quite as popular, but he's another late-night talk guy and does very irreverent kinds of interviews and humor. How many of you know who Jon Stewart is? Now, I didn't. I didn't know who Jon Stewart was. I wasn't familiar with him. Someone tell us, who's Jon Stewart? MTV, okay. All right. What's he been responsible for? You know of anything that he's done that we'd know about? Okay. All right. Letterman's smart aleck spirit permeates The Simpsons. Does everybody know what The Simpsons is? Okay. How about South Park? Everybody know what South Park is? Now, to me, The Simpsons were already way out there and completely unacceptable. But then you go to South Park and you've taken things another step into decadence, into destructive thinking, destructive humor, where you trivialize even life itself. Even life itself, life and death, it's a joke. Nothing means anything. It's all a joke. How about The Onion? Who knows what The Onion is? I didn't until I read about it here. Now, Dale had sent me an email, and he may remember the email. It was about Harry Potter. Someone had sent it to him, and he sent it to me, and he said, "Have you ever done a review of this?" And I read the email, and I thought, man, some of the stuff in here just sounds outrageous. It can't really be true, because I had, in fact, read the Harry Potter books. And the things that it was saying about the books just did not make sense. But I had no idea where it came from. I went to some of the internet sites that talk about urban legends and hoaxes and so forth, and I didn't find anything about this particular email that Dale was asking about. And then I read this, and I shared it with some people, and I didn't know what The Onion was, and somebody told me what The Onion is. Anybody want to tell me, what is The Onion? Anyone? Okay. Saturday Night Live has always had, or I think, some kind of a takeoff on the news. I don't know if they always have or not, but that's something that Saturday Night Live has done, where they kind of lampoon the news and do ridiculous news stories. And The Onion takes that and multiplies it times 400. I mean, they make up utterly absurd news stories that could not possibly be true. And they put in a lot of vulgarity and very powerful, I shouldn't say powerful because it's just the opposite, very weak language. They use all kinds of references that would be taken offensively. Well, from time to time, someone picks up one of the stories off The Onion, and it's happened more than once, and sends it around as though it's legitimate, as though this is a genuine news story. And that happened to be the case behind the email about Harry Potter and all the witchcraft and so forth that was being propagated by the Harry Potter books. The Harry Potter books, if you don't approve of fantasy, you won't approve of the Harry Potter books. That's pure and simple. They're fantasy books. But they are not books that teach witchcraft or teach demonology or teach any of those kinds of things. they are books of fairy tale and fantasy, and that's the realm they're in. If you disapprove of fairy tale and fantasy, you should disapprove of the Harry Potter books. If you don't disapprove of fairy tale and fantasy, you should not disapprove of the Harry Potter books. That's the distinction there. They're not anything particularly unique or unusual in that area. But we're talking about The Onion, not Harry Potter. All right, the humor that is there on The Onion, and I use the word kind of lightly, I visited the site one time to see if that was indeed the source of the Harry Potter story, and it was. It was in their files there. And I was not at all happy to be there, even in a room by myself, with the vulgarity and so forth that was very much in evidence on the site. And then we go to Tom Green. Who knows who Tom Green is? Comedian, very, very what? Very vulgar, okay. Coarse, vulgar, profane. We had the word up there a minute ago, profane, coarse, vulgar. All right, that's all his humor is about. I've seen one routine of his on television, and I didn't know who I was seeing at the time. I found out later who I was seeing at the time, where he's wearing an umpire's outfit and asking people to hit him in the groin and kick him in the groin, and this is funny, you know. That's the level of Tom Green's humor, is toilet or below. That's what his humor is really about. And then we have SportsCenter, and who knows what SportsCenter is? Where would I find it? ESPN? Okay. I thought it was on Comedy Central. I was wrong about that. I've never seen it. I don't know. I don't really know anything about SportsCenter except for where it is on the list. Okay, so what the writer of this TV Guide article is talking about is the fact that there is a kind of progression here, and if you recognize some of these names, you can probably recognize the direction that he's talking about things going. I was talking to a man who is an unbeliever recently, and he was talking about South Park and how bad it was, and it was banned in his house. And he was saying that it seemed to him that once you reach the bottom, then there's really nothing to do except start going back up again. And he felt like that with South Park and some of these kinds of comedy, that we had reached the bottom. Because once you've been outrageous about everything sexual and everything physical and everything involving bodily functions and even death and dismemberment, once you've been outrageous about those things, what is there left to be outrageous about? And there's only one direction you can go. I wish he was right. I don't think he was right, though. I don't think that he was correct in thinking that once you reach bottom, there's really only one thing left to do. You know, when you're in a hole, as I've heard someone say, then the first thing you have to do to get out of the hole is stop digging. And it seems to me that the digging has not by any means stopped. When nothing is sacred, and this last quote from the article in the TV Guide, the frat boys who used to worship him like Zeus now prefer cruder fare like MTV's Jackass. Who knows what Jackass is? Was. It's canceled, but who knows what it was? Someone tell me what it was. And stupid doesn't even go far enough in what we're talking about. Stupid as in bodily harm. Stupid as in challenging people to dive into pits of sewage and things of that nature. Stupid as in beyond the pale of anything that's reasonable, and all in the name of humor. And lots of young people have been injured trying to do routines that were reminiscent of things that were depicted on Jackass. Well, I wanted to focus in this particular quote on the idea of frat boys. What are frat boys? Got a lot of terms to define here tonight. What are they? Fraternity. Where do you have a fraternity? College. Okay, these are college guys that hang together in some kind of a club, okay? Fraternity guys who used to worship David Letterman like Zeus, now prefer cruder fare like MTV's Jackass. So, yeah, David Letterman is certainly not the bottom of the barrel. The barrel, you know, you can scrape considerably lower than that if you care to. But I wanted to think just for a second about the very kind of terminology that we have and that we're using there in the context of when nothing is sacred. Does anybody know what this is depicted on the wall up here right now? A razor. A razor. Gillette for women. Venus. Who's Venus? Goddess of love. The Greek, and that's not familial love, that's erotic love that we're talking about. Venus, the goddess of erotic love, that was the Roman name for that Greek goddess. And what does the slogan say about this razor? Reveal the goddess in you. Now, is that offensive? See, if I had asked a crowd of believers that question 25 years ago, everyone would have said, yes, that's offensive. Reveal the goddess in you. What are we talking about here? But in fact, the bar has been lowered considerably to where those kinds of things don't strike the kind of chord that they should, where it's trivial to talk about having a god or a goddess inside of ourselves, of being a deity. Well, you know, there's been a lot of indoctrination along those lines in our culture in the past generation. The whole New Age movement kind of thing, the Eastern mysticism that talks about us all having deity within ourselves, the God potential within us, all kinds of ways that that's handled. But it's come to the point where you can use this kind of language. That should be very powerful and disturbing language to talk about gods and goddesses. But it's gotten to the point where that kind of language just doesn't mean much to people anymore. And to talk about revealing the goddess in you means what? I don't know. What does that mean? Hairy women are not attractive. Well, I have been so far as to go to the Venus Razor website and look at their little, they got a little sort of, not a game exactly, but a little thing you can click on, and it's for young women. It's not for me, because I don't, you know, they've got a men's version of this, but they don't say reveal the God in you for some reason. I've been to the website and I clicked on the thing, and it asks you to put in your name, and it's going to reveal the goddess in you, and it takes your name and turns it into an acronym with all these little words to tell what a tremendous person you are. It's on the level of, well, a poor Chinese fortune cookie. But the thing is, this kind of marketing isn't nearly as disturbing as it ought to be, because it displays a mentality that has become pervasive in the culture in which we live, where nothing is sacred, not even deity is sacred. A little taste of heaven. Do you know what that's an ad for? Cream cheese. Yeah. A little taste of heaven. And there's a gal there wearing some wings and a halo. And the newspaper version of that said, try the darker side of cheesecake heaven. That kind of language, again, kind of disturbs me, because it says something about where we are as a culture. And the fact that I know a whole lot of people who are believers in Jesus wouldn't be at all disturbed about this kind of language bothers me even more. It tells me something about where we are as a culture in terms of defining things that are truly important. And I don't know that you can read it down here toward the bottom of the screen. What's that say? New Chocolate Decadence. It was a newspaper ad, and it wasn't very, very finely grained to begin with. New Chocolate Decadence, that's the name on the product, Chocolate Decadence. Now, what is decadence? Is a chocolate ice cream bar with or without cream cheese decadent? I can find scores of ads that talk about decadence in this way. Is decadence a good thing? When did decadence become a good thing? What is decadence? There we have a good question. What is decadence, while we're talking about defining terms? What is it to be decadent? Without rules of conduct, nothing limits your indulgence of your appetites. Decadence is indulging your appetites without limits. Now, when I think of the word decadent, I think of Caligula, the Roman emperor. Okay, somebody who had the means, the opportunity, and the desire to indulge his tastes to the extreme, to use boys as sex slaves and take their lives on a whim, and all those, that's decadent. Eating a chocolate bar is not decadent. Well, it shouldn't be, okay? But when you start using this kind of language to define this kind of activity, what you're doing is robbing the language of its very meaning, and the meaning of words are important. If this is decadent, then where do you go from there? How do you define what is bad behavior? What is indeed unacceptable and inappropriate. Going back to the cover quote about David Letterman, I'm going to, since there aren't any children in here tonight, are there? They're all out in the classroom. So I'm going to go ahead and read it. I don't like to reinforce the language here, and you may think that's kind of strange and funny that this language would really bother me, but I'll come to why it does pretty soon. Energized, refreshed, so gosh darn funny, now more than ever, nothing is sacred in the world of David Letterman. Isn't that great? Is it great when nothing is sacred? When there's no distinction between the sacred and the profane, when language that should define things that are very special, define things that are very ordinary and very commonplace, when people are unable to distinguish between what matters and what doesn't matter, and I've got to be careful about talking with this thing in my hand. Well, you know what the picture now is depicting, don't you? That's a satellite picture of the aftermath of September 11th in New York City. TV Guide said, nothing is sacred in the world of David Letterman. Now more than ever, nothing is sacred in the world of David Letterman. And then along came the plane crashes on September 11th, and David Letterman didn't know what to do. He did not know what to do. He wasn't on TV that night, or the next night, or for the next week. He didn't know what to do. When nothing is sacred. This is from September 19th, from the Los Angeles Times. Jay Leno gave tonight over to a foreign policy discussion with Senator John McCain on Tuesday as terrorism continued to redefine Hollywood entertainment. On Monday, David Letterman's Late Show returned on an equally solemn note, with the host and CBS News anchor Dan Rather emotionally recounting the devastation of September 11th. When Politically Correct resumed Monday, host Bill Maher said the attack had altered his show as well as the country. All of a sudden, in David Letterman's life, in David Letterman's world, something loomed large. Something became sacred. What caused that change? Well, his show comes from New York, doesn't it? And he knew people that were there at the Trade Towers. And this was something that was not just a landmark, but a part of his life that was impacted so severely on that day and at that time. And it was a crushing experience for him. I tuned him in, not the first night he was back on, but I tuned him in the second night he was back on just to see what his demeanor was. And he didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to say. He didn't know how to make any jokes, because any of the kinds of jokes he was accustomed to making were inappropriate. He didn't have a base to fall back on of anything that he could really trust in, put his confidence in, anything that is sacred, that is to say, worthy of respect, something on which he could pin his grief and deal with it in a way that in any way indicated normalcy in his life. Normalcy accelerates healing. This is from the same article, September 19th, LA Times. Normalcy accelerates healing, making television as usual a fine thing for a badly wounded nation hearing the terrible thunder of war. It was swell seeing baseball on TV again. And by the way, that word made me think about David Letterman even before I read on in the article. Swell is a David Letterman kind of word. It was swell seeing baseball on TV again, balls again flying out of the park, nasty curveballs, still nasty, pitchers getting right to it and not taking 5 miles an hour off of their fastballs. It was comforting as well, watching Monday night's return of David Letterman on CBS, the irreverent comic reborn for the moment as a tortured observer trying mightily to define his own feelings in a monologue notable for its aching sincerity. Again, in the world of David Letterman, there are things that are sacred. No matter how he talks, no matter how he has presented himself in the course of the last several years of defining his comic image, there are things that cut to the very heart of the man and disturb him tremendously. We cannot live our lives in a way that has nothing sacred, nothing worthy of respect. Same article, Howard Rosenberg. Here's more common wisdom. U.S. television, which beamed those terrorist acts and their aftermath to the world, will never be the same. Talk about a cosmic impact. Television, after all, is just about everyone's extended family. I don't read on yet. Go with me for a minute on those first couple of sentences. He says, this is common wisdom, that television will never be the same. Okay, that's what people were saying in the first couple of weeks after the September 11th disaster. Television will never be the same. Was that true or false? That's false. And that's what Howard Rosenberg is going to say before this article is over, is that's absurd, because people don't want it to be fundamentally different. People don't want to have that changed in any significant way. He says, talk about a cosmic impact. Television, after all, is just about everyone's extended family. Is that right? Well, actually, I think that is right. It's a tremendous unifying force in our nation. It unifies people in so many ways as to their attitudes, their values, their appetites, the things that they want most in life are defined to a tremendous extent by what is depicted on that little screen in the, well, maybe it's a big screen. They're getting bigger all the time, aren't they, in the living room. It's the electronic campfire around which we all gather into the wee hours of the to hear and witness tales of life that shape how we see ourselves in the world. I agree with Mr. Rosenberg about that, but that statement also struck a particular chord in me when he talks about it being the campfire that we gather around. Some of you were here when I came back from Ghana and I told the congregation here about experiences that I'd had in Ghana, and you may or may not remember that one of those experiences that struck me was one night when we went for a long, long drive halfway across the country of Ghana. We went through a village, and everybody in the village was gathered together, and it was like 50 or 60 people. They were all gathered together around a 19-inch black and white TV. The whole village in the dark was gathered around this TV. Now, I asked a question recently in San Jose about how the world sees America because of American television programs that are available worldwide, and Ning Desina, who's from the Philippines, had a ready answer to that, and her answer was the same to mine. It's an awful picture of America that people worldwide have because of the things that we send into their homes from our entertainment industry. Which would you rather have, that people all over the world have a dynasty perspective of America, or a Baywatch perspective of America, or a David Letterman perspective? I mean, where do you want to go with this, to think that people are going to think we're anything but either greedy fools or belligerent bullies, or what are they going to think? America is so wealthy that they don't know what to do with their wealth. They're always squabbling over petty issues. What kind of picture is presented to the rest of the world in terms of values as they gather around this communal campfire to see what America is doing now? And you know, in Ghana, they think CNN is the greatest thing there is, because they know that if they watch the news produced in their local stations, that is to say by their own government, that it's going to be propagandized. It's not going to give an accurate world picture, because it's going to be tainted by the influence of the government. So they watch CNN to get the real picture of how things are. But alas, the terrorism-triggered revolution of TV is vastly overstated. Short-term changes, yes. Long-term, no. And he was certainly right about that. It didn't take long to get the fall season underway and get all the same old garbage going once again. We can expect late-night comics Jay Leno, David Letterman, and others whose monologues usually take no political prisoners to continue shying away from their customary presidential slams, yet all of this is temporary. Americans may never be the same, but they want their television to be. They want their culture to be. They don't want fundamental changes in their culture and the expectations that are laid upon them by the culture in which we live. There was an idea conveyed to Aaron and his sons, an idea that was strengthened by the fact that two of his sons had just died. Okay, the 10th chapter of Leviticus recounts to us the death of two of Aaron's sons, because they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord. The Lord had told them a procedure during the process of their commissioning, and they were in the last day of their commissioning, and God expressed his approval for what had happened at the end of the 9th chapter of Leviticus. God expressed his approval of what had happened by filling the tabernacle with glory, and causing the burnt offering to be consumed with fire that came out from his presence in the tabernacle. It was a splendid, exciting day. And Aaron's two older sons got so excited, Nadab and Abihu, that they took it upon themselves to start celebrating in a way that God had not told them to do. And he had given them a script to follow for that time and that series of events. And they stepped away from the script. And they filled their censers with incense, and they put them on fire, and they started doing stuff with the incense. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord a second time and took their lives. They died. And God told Aaron at that time, you must distinguish between the holy and the common, between the unclean and the clean. And you must teach the Israelites all the decrees the Lord has given them through Moses. You must distinguish between the holy and the common. God said, my name is going to be held holy before these people. And he would not allow his priests to profane his name in the way that they did with the actions that they took on that day. Ezekiel chapter 22 and verse 26, many, many, many years later, Ezekiel is talking about the situation that existed in Jerusalem. This is almost 1,000 years later that Ezekiel is talking about the situation in Jerusalem. And he says, her priests do violence to my law and profane my holy things. They do not distinguish between the holy and the common. God thought it was important to make a distinguish between what is holy and what is common, between what is sacred and what is profane. They do not distinguish between the holy and the common. They teach that there is no difference between the unclean and the clean, and they shut their eyes to the keeping of my Sabbath so that I am profaned among them. What's the outcome of making the holy and the common the same thing? What's the outcome of taking the sacred and the profane and treating them as the same? Well, God says the outcome is, I am profaned among them. God himself is reduced from his exalted position as the heavenly Father, the Creator, the glorious King of all. This is the very thing that Paul describes in the first chapter of Romans, verses 17 and following, when he talks about man's descent into decadence. When he talks about first, they're not grateful to the God who made them, and then they step away from the image of God and substitute the images of created things. And then they get into all kinds of sexual deviancy, and they become haters of parents. And he goes down this progression that ends up redefining who God is and what God is, the nature of God, and redefining man in his relationship with God and man in his relationship with other human beings. So that I am profaned among them, he said to Ezekiel. There's a word that I use a lot. The word is trivialize. Trivial means of little significance or value, ordinary or commonplace. You know, there are some songs that I'm not fond of because they trivialize important things. The kinds of entertainment that I have been mentioning in the course of this lesson tonight, I have a problem with it because it trivializes important things. It takes things that are of genuine value and it makes them of little significance, little value. Now, sarcasm tends to be that kind of humor. David Letterman's wit tends to be sarcastic wit, tends to be demeaning. When I was a high school student, I learned, I'm not sure that I started learning it there, I'm not suggesting I didn't start it even sooner than that, but I learned it to a very fine degree because that was what my friends and I thought was funny, was to look for ways to put each other down with sarcasm. And I have a real problem with that to this day, of being able to not dispense the sarcasm inappropriately, and it's really hard to dispense sarcasm appropriately. Sarcasm is humor that demeans someone else, that takes something special and makes it ordinary, that takes something sacred and makes it profane. And I'm really leery of thinking that that's a very good idea, even though I still very naturally fall into that kind of biting exchange with people. The put-downs, the little jokes about character and quality that come so readily and are so potentially devastating. When nothing is sacred, things are trivialized. Things are made to seem less important than they are. I made reference back in talking about Jackass, the MTV program, to being below toilet humor. You know, it amazes me. I guess it shouldn't amaze me, but it amazes me how much of what is presented as being family entertainment today includes doses of toilet humor and various other demeaning kinds of behaviors, actions, words that I consider utterly inappropriate. I won't go into specific examples, but trivialization of what it is to be a human being. Ezekiel 44 and 23, this was the task that the priests were to have in the new temple, the temple that Ezekiel prophesied about, the great and glorious temple where God's presence was to be there in the temple, a prophecy which I think is about the church. The priests in that new temple that was to come were to teach my people the difference between the holy and the common and show them how to distinguish between the clean, the unclean, and the clean. Now, who are the priests in God's temple today? Christians are. That's one of the things it means to be a Christian, is to be a priest in the temple of God. His temple is his church. That's really tomorrow night's lesson to make that point, but his temple is the church. He dwells in and among his people, and his people are his priests, a called and chosen nation, a royal priesthood. And his priests are to teach people the difference between the holy and the common and show them how to distinguish between the unclean and the clean. And I assure you, you cannot learn those distinctions out there, because those distinctions have been largely abandoned in the world in which we live. We are indeed in a crooked and depraved generation. Trivializing attitudes and words. Jesus said in Matthew 5, 21, 22, you've heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Now, among other things, Jesus is talking about trivializing people here. When you're angry with someone and you begin to think of them in unflattering terms and talk about them in destructive terms, you're trivializing that person. You may not ever act on that physically, but whenever we go to war, what do we do as a means of justifying that war? Well, we begin to trivialize the people who are the opposition, to paint them as being ludicrous in terms of their evil, in terms of their ability, in terms of their goals, their designs. That's one of the goals, one of the purposes of the whole idea of propaganda, is to trivialize the enemy, to make them seem a little less than human, so that it's okay to bomb them and shoot them and all those kinds of things. Well, Jesus brings that down to an everyday level. We have no right to do that to our brother, as he says here, to trivialize them, to reduce their status as a child of God, as a fellow human being. And he says we put ourselves in danger of the fire of hell when we do that. Now, when I read this passage as a child, of course, I was reading it in the King James Version, but when I read this passage as a child, I had no problem with that word raca. I wasn't going to call anybody raca. Why would I say that? That wasn't in my vocabulary at all. But that word fool, that kind of bothered me. And being a good little Pharisee, and most of us have the capability within us, being a good little Pharisee, I did not call my brother fool, because Jesus said, if you call your brother fool, you'll be in danger of hellfire. So I called him stupid. And I called him idiot and dummy and all kinds of other expressions, but I never called him fool. That's trivializing, isn't it? That is taking the idea that Jesus was conveying here, and it is completely sidestepping it and trivializing my brother. My brother is one of the dearest people on earth, the brother that I used to call all those names, one of the finest people on earth. That's my brother Dennis that I'm talking about here, and any of you who know him, when I was growing up as a teenager and doing the kinds of things that brothers do to one another. Trivializing attitudes and words. Well, when I called my brother stupid, so you may find that word very offensive, but the fact is what I was doing was using a euphemism, a substitute word, because I thought the word fool is really bad. So I used a substitute word. Euphemisms are the act or an example of substituting a mild, indirect, or vague term for one considered harsh, blunt, or offensive. Now, I did that. It was my little Pharisaic effort to be right with the law and ignore the spirit of the commandment. And we have a tendency to do that in many, many areas, to take things that are sacred and make them commonplace by trying to work around the letter of the law, by trying to stay within a carefully defined parameter of doing what is strictly right, but really ignoring the intent of the commandment. The commandment that we love our neighbor as ourselves, the commandment that we esteem others better than ourselves, the commandment that we serve God and Him only, the commandments that have to do with very basic and fundamental choices in life. In Matthew 12, verses 34 through 37, and this one bothered me a lot too as a youngster, a young man, "You brood of vipers, how can you who are evil say anything good? For out of the overflow of the heart the mouth speaks. The good man brings good things out of the good things stored up, out of the good stored up in him, and the evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in him. But I tell you that men will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every careless word they have spoken." Now, doesn't that bother you? "Men will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every careless word they have spoken. For by your words you will be acquitted, and by your words you will be condemned." Now, I can remember a time when I confronted a guy that was a couple years older than me as a teenager, because he had said to one of our common friends, and we were church members, all of us were, he had said to another man, to another teenager, "Well, I'm going to kill you for that." And I chastised him. How could you say a thing like that? Don't you realize by your words you'll be committed and by your words you'll be condemned? Don't you realize that for every careless word that you speak, you're going to stand in judgment? Meanwhile, I was still calling my brother stupid idiot. Okay. I could see the speck in my brother's eye. I think that those kinds of language, those kinds of terms, in fact, do make a difference. They, in fact, are important. More important than we want to own up to. And I am going to touch on these words before I leave this topic behind: when nothing is sacred, trivializing attitudes and words. There's a list of words up here, and none of these words actually have a definition. None of these words came into existence in the way that words ordinarily come into existence to describe a thing or an action. The words "gosh golly" are, as it says in brackets there, an alteration of God. And that's entirely why those words were invented. Was people who didn't want to take God's name in vain, but they wanted to say what everybody else was saying, so they invented a euphemism, an alteration of God. That's just straight out of the dictionary. I did not alter that in the least. That's just the American Heritage Dictionary. The word "G" is just an alteration of Jesus, used as a mild expletive. Why do we need any kind of an expletive? Do we need a mild expletive? A strong expletive? Why do we need an expletive at all? What did Jesus say about that? "Let your yes be yes and your no be no." That's what he said about that. And this kind of trivializing language takes words that really mean something — God, Jesus, hell, damn, those words really mean something — and trivializes them so that when people say those words, or when people say the euphemisms that are derived from those words, there isn't any meaningful content there. Something sacred has been made profane. Something holy has been made common. We need to be able to talk to people seriously about God, about Jesus, about hell, about damnation. We need to talk about these things in a serious way and not get caught up in the trap of demeaning language that takes the impact out of the very words that we use to talk about sacred things. In 1 Kings 3:9, Solomon prayed, "So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong, for who is able to govern this great people of yours?" Solomon prayed for a discerning heart to be able to tell the difference between right and wrong. And the text indicates that God gave him that very thing. And then he brushed it off in favor of his own appetites and his curiosity and experimentation and all kinds of things. But what he prayed for was a good thing: a discerning heart and being able to distinguish between right and wrong. Hebrews 5, 12 through 14 says, "In fact, though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you the elementary truths of God's word all over again. You need milk, not solid food, Anyone who lives on milk, being still an infant, is not acquainted with the teaching about righteousness, but solid food is for the mature, who by constant use have trained themselves to distinguish good and evil. That's the part that was missing with Solomon. He prayed for it, and God gave him the capacity for it, but he didn't train himself to distinguish good and evil. He said, I'm just going to try it all. I'll see what's out there and see what works and see what feels good and see what satisfies. And none of it did. The writer of Hebrews says that distinguishing between good and evil, the fact is we've all got the capacity for that. But the fact is we need to train ourselves by constant use, making distinctions between what is sacred and what is profane, what matters and what doesn't. In 1 Peter chapter 4 and verses 3 through 5, Peter said, you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do. Following Venus and all that kind of stuff, right? You have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery. That's pretty nearly synonymous with decadence. Living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. They think it strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. Is there a flood of dissipation in the world that we live in? Oh, I would have to say that there is. But we ought not to plunge into the flood of dissipation and get caught up in the same appetites and efforts to satisfy them, which never actually work, that the rest of the world is pursuing. And going back again to Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, remember what Paul said about the character that Christians are supposed to have. And by the way, tomorrow night we're going to talk about several things that are holy. I haven't specifically talked about very many things tonight that are holy and should be held in respect, but we'll be talking about that tomorrow night. Philippians 2, 14 and 15, again, Paul said, do everything without complaining or arguing. You know why that is? Do you ever go away from church and complain about the way it was at church that day? The little story I like about that a lot is one of the two parents with the little boy, and as they're driving away from church, the mom comments on the sermon and the dad comments on the song leader, and the little boy in back says, well, I thought it was a pretty good show for a dollar. And the point is well taken, that they were trivializing something important in more ways than one. In many ways, they were. The Bible takes a real hard line on being complainers, on being people who grumble in their tents, because it diminishes things that are genuinely important in our lives. And it communicates messages to our children about what's truly important in our lives. And we need to be wary of those things. Do everything without complaining or arguing. Okay, have this attitude about the sacred, things that are worthy of respect. Don't tear down things that are worthy of respect. So that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a crooked and depraved generation in which you shine like stars in the universe. Paul and Peter wanted us to see that there is a real distinction between the rest of culture and ourselves as Christians. As Christians, it means that we hold holy things to be holy, that we have respect for humankind as being made in the image of God, that we have respect for our brothers and sisters as children of God, that we have respect for God as our Lord and Master and the one who will determine the destiny of our souls, just to name a few of the things in which we need to invest respect, a sense of the sacred, a sense of holiness, including a sense of being sacred vessels ourselves. We are to shine like stars in a dark universe. We are to be different than the world in which we live in a noticeable way. It means to be a Christian. What it means to be a Christian is to actually be a light in a world in which people celebrate when nothing is sacred. That is, they celebrate until disaster comes. And only in Christ are we prepared for the disaster. If anyone tonight is not in Christ, then it would be a good time to make that commitment to turn your life over to Him and be safe in a refuge that nothing can assail. Or if any of our brothers and sisters in the audience need help, need encouragement, need prayers, you're invited to let the church know about that. If you need to become a Christian, we invite you to come before the church during this song, or if you need the church to pray for you, pray with you, help you overcome a terrible obstacle in your life, we invite you to come during this song.